Wholesale prices are going up at the fastest pace since 2008.
Is this inflation or just a healthy economic rebound?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, February 16th. Coming up, one of the world's largest drug makers snatches up one of America's largest biotech firms. Also, at New York's Fashion Week, cotton is becoming something of a luxury.
But first, to this morning's inflation numbers from the Labor Department, wholesale prices jumped almost 1% in January thanks to a 7% rise in gas prices. The core index, which doesn't include food and energy prices, was up 0.5%. Let's bring in Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group. He's with us now from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So are you concerned by these inflation numbers?
Personally, I'm not. Now, you know, I need to qualify that because if you buy gasoline, people do, you're looking at a 20% price increase over the past year, and that's not something to dismiss. And if you buy food, and everyone does that, those prices have gone up a bunch too. So for a lot of people and a lot of businesses, this is real inflation. But for central bankers, the likes of Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, it's a bit less of a concern.
Explain that. Why is this not the kind of inflation that would scare Ben Bernanke, who's obviously been pumping a lot of money into the economy?
Right. They put about $2 trillion of money into the economy in the past year. But commodity prices are incredibly volatile. They go up, they go down. Underlying inflation tends to be much more stable. And here's what he said just 20 days ago. Although commodity prices have risen, longer-term inflation expectations have remained stable, and measures of underlying inflation have been trending downward. It's that underlying rate that really preoccupies them. That has been modest over the past year, just up 1.6%.
All right. Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group, thanks so much as always.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Let's get another view now from David Weiss. He's chief economist at S&P. He's with us now from New York. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Tell us what this data is saying. Is inflation starting to rear its head?
Well, we're seeing a little bit of inflation out there. Most of it so far is in energy, which obviously doesn't have much to do with us. That has more to do with demand growth in China. But excluding food and energy, 0.5% for the month, heavily in the import categories, reflecting in part a weak dollar.
The import as in like all kinds of things coming in from other countries.
Yeah, especially areas like men's apparel, toys, footwear, you know, the stuff we buy from overseas.
Let's break it down a little bit and talk about what areas we should be most concerned about as far as rising prices go.
Obviously, energy is the big item. 1.8% in the month, up, you know, very sharply from where we were a year ago, 9%. And you're seeing that at the gas pump. Obviously, I think everybody knows about that one. We're seeing some big increases this month in areas like alcoholic beverages, which may reflect beginning of year tax hikes at the state level. Surprisingly, food was less of a problem.
Food
this
prices,
month.
Okay. Really?
That slowed down a bit, in part because we had some big increase in December, November, which dropped off a bit in January.
All right. David Weiss joining us from S&P in New York. David, thank you.
Thank you.
The second largest bookseller in the country is bankrupt. Borders has been inching toward bankruptcy, and today the company made it official. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more on what this means for the book business.
Borders will continue to operate, but it's essentially lost the bookselling battle to online sales from Amazon and devices like the Kindle, iPad, and Nook from direct competitor Barnes & Noble. Joseph Feldman is with Telsey Advisory Group. He says Barnes & Noble at least saw the digital revolution coming.
Barnes & Noble was a lot faster to shift and to try to participate in this whole digital, you know, e-reading market. Borders was late to it, and as a result, I think they've never been able to catch up.
It's hard to catch up when you've been in survival mode as long as Borders. It's changed management, cut jobs, and tried to shift around its debt. Now, with the bankruptcy filing, Borders will close up to 200 locations. And Feldman says that hurts more than book shoppers.
That's a big dent in orders to the book publishers.
Those publishers are themselves scrambling to adjust to the digital marketplace. And with 200 fewer retail outlets for books, that transition speeds up. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Imagine you're one of the 14 million unemployed people in this country. You're trying to find a new job, and the ads you're looking at say only employed people need apply. Well, that's the subject of a hearing today at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Minnesota resident Kevin McCall says job postings often have this message: you need a job to get a job.
I definitely see a lot more must present recent work.
McCall has been looking for permanent work since he was laid off from Circuit City 2 years ago.
It really bums one out.
Hoyt Blakely teaches economics at the University of Chicago. He says employers have good reason to want workers with jobs.
Because what the employer is ultimately interested in is how productive that worker is going to be.
And while it may be legal to look at employment status, Chris Owens of the National Employment Law Project says it may also be discriminatory.
A policy that would exclude unemployed workers is going to fall more harshly on African Americans because their unemployment rate is almost twice that of white workers.
New Jersey, for one, is considering legislation that would stop employers from excluding the jobless, at least in job postings. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, the 16th day of February. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. The French pharmaceutical giant Sanofi Aventis. Did I say that right, Steve?
You said it right. Sanofi.
Sanofi Aventis.
That's right. There you go.
Will
nice.
Pay $20 billion for Genzyme. Did I say that one right?
I think you did.
All right, so good. And that's an American biotech firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The BBC's John Bithrie is in London. I think I said his name right. And he has more on this mega deal that's sure to make some waves. Hi, John.
Hello, Steve.
Now, why has this French firm picked up Genzyme? What do they want with Genzyme?
Well, Sanofi Aventis is France's biggest drug maker. It's been after Genzyme for a while, largely because Sanofi doesn't have many new drugs of its own in the pipeline, and it's facing competition from generic producers. Genzyme makes a lot of treatments for rare diseases. Its best-selling drug, Cerazyme, treats liver and neurological problems. It's also producing a new range of drugs for high cholesterol.
$20 billion, John, is a lot of money. Is this a good deal for Sanofi?
Well, it's not as good a deal as it would have liked. It launched a hostile bid last September for $18.5 billion. That failed, and it's had to up that to more than $20 billion to get the board to agree. But Genzyme did have some production glitches of its best-selling drugs a couple of years back, and that actually pulled down its value, making it more vulnerable to a takeover. But this is still the biggest deal in the drug industry since Merck bought Schering Plough in 2009.
The BBC's John Bithrie in London. John, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
A new report out from the World Bank says global food prices have hit dangerous levels. They've jumped 29% in the last year. And the World Bank says the increasing cost of food has sent 44 million people into poverty. The situation is especially bad in developing countries. But what about the impact of rising food prices here in the U.S.? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
In developing countries, people often spend more than half their income on food. So when prices rise even a little, it can have a big impact. The situation is different here in the U.S. Dan Bossi is president of Ag Resource Company, an economic consulting firm. He says Americans only spend about 10% of their disposable income on food.
So if it goes up 1 or 2 percentage points on disposable income, maybe we have to cut back in a few areas, but it really doesn't change our style of life.
He expects food prices in the U.S. will rise 3 to 4% this year. That's partly due to global demand from India and China. Also, ethanol deserves some of the blame. It consumes almost half of America's corn. But Bossi says ethanol also accounts for about 10% of our fuel supply.
Ultimately, eliminating ethanol would cause gasoline prices to rise. We estimate about 70 cents a gallon.
He says a spike at the gas pump would be harder on American consumers than the moderate increases expected at the grocery store. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You heard about wholesale prices here in the United States today. Well, over in Britain, their latest inflation report shows consumer prices continue to rise by more than what's comfortable to the country's central bank. From London, here's reporter Christopher Worth.
In many ways, the UK is a special case. A recent hike in sales tax is partly to blame for the higher prices British consumers are having to pay. At the same time, those higher prices are also being driven by increasing demand in emerging markets such as China and India, which is pushing up the cost of fuel and commodities. Bank officials argue these are just temporary factors, but Marie Duran, an economist with Oxford Economics, questions just how temporary they are.
There's a risk that this temporary phenomenon is actually quite a long phenomenon, because there's no sign of oil prices coming down for a long time.
And those rising fuel and commodity prices are spilling over into the rest of Europe. Last month, inflation in the eurozone nudged up to 2.4%, also well above the European Central Bank's target. That means central banks in the UK and Europe are in a tough position. The rising cost of living puts them under pressure to begin raising interest rates in order to curb inflation. However, the fragile economic recovery may depend on those rates remaining low for some time to come. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Next week, Australian farmers, Jeremy, will be the latest to deposit seeds in a vault near the North Pole. Actually, they're going to be depositing several types of peas and chickpeas, okay? Huh. Just in case there's a food emergency, in case some calamitous event happens where the earth is swallowed whole by aliens. I don't know. Something could happen, though,
where
we need seeds to reinstate crops, right, on the planet. So the concrete bunker that they have deposited these seeds in was built by Norwegians. It's a former mine turned secure storage freezer. The vault is elevated to avoid rising water. It's buried deep in permafrost, so the seeds will always stay preserived. The place never goes above 4 below 0 Fahrenheit.
Sounds like they've got their bases covered there.
They do. And guarding against any human malfeasance, in case anyone tries to get funny with the seeds, polar bears all over the place. Polar bears. Yeah. You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, February 16th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles, on Twitter, by the way, at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York, on Twitter, at Jeremy Hobson. And you can also give us your feedback by going to marketplace.org. You can click on the link that says Contact. And that site, by the way, Steve, is going to get a few changes in the coming days.
Yeah, so I think we're looking forward to those. Yeah,
it'll be a nice big new change on marketplace.org.
You know what else is changing, Jeremy?
What?
Fashion.
What?
I mean, by the day. How's that for a segue? You like that? Fashion week, Jeremy, is in full swing in New York, right? And the big trends this year, relaxed cuts and lots of texture and tones that are pastel-like or look like jewels. And fabrics usually reserved for an evening on the town. You would usually take your silk scarves or a fur coat or something like that.
I never go anywhere without my silk scarves.
That's what I'm saying. Well, now they're making more appearances during the day. But everyday cotton, I mean, just the cotton you would wear, like a T-shirt, something like that, it's becoming more of a luxury. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
At the Cynthia Rowley Fashion Show, models glide along a glowing gold runway in patent leather jackets, slouchy silk jumpsuits, tattered velvet skirts, and, that old mainstay, cotton. Backstage, designer Rowley says the rising price of cotton has changed its status.
Now there are fabrics that maybe we took for granted that can be more like a luxury fabric.
Wholesale cotton prices jumped more than 90% last year. Drought, conflict in the Middle East, increased demand from China and India, and market speculation all played a role. And prices don't look like they'll be coming down anytime soon. So designers and retailers are scrambling to come up with new fabrics for spring and summer, says Candace Corlett with WSL Strategic Retail.
Retailers are very much caught in the middle because they are now being squeezed between the higher prices to buy the goods and a shopper who has learned to walk away if the prices are too high.
Designers like Isaac Mizrahi and Derek Lamb are using more blends and alternative fabrics like polyester and rayon. They're also turning to more eco-friendly fabrics, says Milton Pedraza with the Luxury Institute.
The meteoric rise of cotton has precipitated yet another trend, which is to use new products such as bamboo or to use recycled fabrics.
H&M's forthcoming Conscious Collection uses recycled polyester and cellulose fabric, as well as organic cotton. Speedo recently created a line of dresses from recycled swimsuits.
You know, it's been cotton for a long time, but what's coming next? I mean, this is an opportunity for creative marketers.
Candice Corlett's prediction for the next big fabric?
I think that there'll be a lot of adjectives preceding the word cotton.
Wrinkle-free cotton, seaweed cotton, polyester cotton, recycled cotton. Corlett says cotton won't disappear from our wardrobes, but the pure stuff will probably be more common on the runways than it will on the discount racks. She predicts cotton will be less the fabric of our lives and more the fabric of the good life. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Credit card fraud jumped 62% last year. That's according to the electronic payment software company ACI Worldwide. The company says 29% of us have been the victim of credit card fraud in the past 5 years. Steve, I have been the victim of credit card fraud 3 times in that
You've
period.
Mentioned that on this very program.
I have. Have you,
yes.
Have you ever had your credit card number stolen?
Of course. I've had a debit card taken from an ATM machine, as a matter of fact.
Well, it is happening more often, and let's get the latest on this and what we can do about it from LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. He joins us now. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So this is becoming a real problem.
It's been a big problem for quite some time. The growing use of plastic simply means that there's growing potential for getting ripped off when you use it. You really got to be smart when you use a credit card.
But why is this happening right now?
Well, there's a number of reasons. On the one hand, you could say that we don't have sufficient security measures in place here in the United States. For example, in Europe, most of the plastic has chips embedded in it. They're smart. Right. They've got encryption. And they basically are able to defend themselves better. We're not quite there yet here in the U.S. Another thing, too, is just simply the growing use of mobile devices and Wi-Fi. A lot of people are accessing the internet on the go or using unsecure connections like at Starbucks or something else. And the simple fact is, if you go e-shopping using a Wi-Fi connection, I'm not going to say you're going to get ripped off every time, but the chances of someone seeing what you're doing and walking away with your number are exponentially higher.
Somebody could be watching that number that you're typing into the screen. David, what can people do to make sure that they're not the victims of credit card fraud?
Well, the first thing is just be smart about it. For example, don't give out your number to anybody who you don't trust. Second of all, be mindful of the whole Wi-Fi phenomenon. If you're having a latte at Starbucks, probably not the best time to go to Amazon.com and go browsing for things. Always use a secure connection when you need it. And finally, there's something called virtual credit cards out there, which hardly anybody seems to know about. But what these are services offered by banks in which they create a separate number based on the full backing of your normal piece of plastic that has all sorts of encryption and other security attached to it. And then when you go e-shopping, you're not using your normal number, you're using this temporary number. And in some cases, after you do your shopping expedition on the internet, poof, the new number goes away.
All right. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Poof, I'm gone.
Poof. You know what else is gone? Cakes. Americans, Steve, it seems, are turning to their smaller brethren, cupcakes.
Cupcakes.
Yes. A research firm, get this, a research firm, a very, very powerful research firm says cupcake pan sales were up 14% last year, and 555 million cupcakes were eaten in the latest 12-month survey period.
Ugh.
Yes, that's right. I did say those statistics came from a research firm.
Yeah.
It's called the NPD Group.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we have just successfully found the sweetest gig in the research business.
I want that job, exactly.
That's right. How many cupcakes is that, Susie? In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chitakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.